Hello, we are sitting here again at Atid with Rabbi Yedidia Sinclair, Rabbi Chaim Bravender, and this is Rabbi Jeff Sachs. And we are looking today at a piece of Rav Kook's teachings from the Ein Ayah, his commentary on various Agadot Chazal, his commentary on the Gemarot that appear in the Ein Yaakov. We're looking at a piece from the second volume of Masechet Brachot in the commentary of the Ein Ayah to the Gemara on Daf Nunchet Omud Aleph. We'll look at that Gemara. You're welcome to download it from the link on our website. And then afterwards we'll talk a little bit about Rav Kook's comments on that Gemara. But our first task, as opposed to earlier sessions, is to understand the text on which Rav Kook is commenting instead of Rav Kook's comments themselves directly. Rabbi Bravender, why don't you help us learn this Gemara?
So maybe I'll first say a word about this book, the Ein Ayah, in which Rav Kook comments on almost all the Agadata in Brachot, and he also began a Perush on Masechet Shabbat as well. This was one of Rav Kook's earlier works. It was written in the 1890s. While he was still in Russia, before he came to Eretz Israel. And it's a very interesting work from the point of view of seeing the development of Rav Kook's thought. Because unlike the text which we've seen so far from Orat HaKodesh, where Rav Kook is writing in a way which is not obviously based on any particular Jewish sources, although you see fragments here and there, here in the Ein Ayah, his starting point is the Gemara. And we see in his comments in the germ, the nucleus of ideas which he develops later on. And so it's very interesting to be able to see where these ideas jump off from in familiar texts from Chazal. So I'd like to see where some of his ideas from art come from based on this Gemara in Brachot Nunchet as interpreted by Rav Kook.
Start from the parentheses.
Yeah.
Beginning.
Yeah.
Omer Rav Hamnuna Haroe Uchluse Yisrael Omer Baruch Hacham Harazim. If you see a large group of Bnei Yisrael, then you have to say this bracha. It's not with Shem Malchus, but it's a bracha. Baruch Chacham Harazim. Razim are secrets. Chacham Harazim. Rashi explains that who knows the hearts of each of these people there. But Uchluse Ovdei Kochavim Omer Busha Imchem. I guess that's not such a positive kind of thing. Then, that's the first name in Rav Hamnuna. Tana Rabbanan, there's a brisa. Haroe Uchluse Yisrael Omer Baruch Hacham Harazim. This is not in the name of Rav Hamnuna. This is a brisa. V'fi she'ein da'atam da'mot zeh lo zeh Chacham Harazim, because their opinions are different one from the other. V'ein partzufeihem da'mot zeh lo zeh, and they don't look any one of them like the other. Ben Zoma, another Tana, Ra'o Chlusa al Gabi Mala b'Harabayis. He saw a large collection of people, right? Very large. Rashi says, Chel Gadol Shishim Ribo. Shishim Ribo is like a mythical, very large number. I mean, it's the number of Jews who left Mitzrayim. So it's like, in some way, it's the ultimate number. Al-Gabi Mala B'Harabayis Omar, Baruch Hacham Harazim, another version, U'Baruch Shebarakol Eilu L'Sham Sheni. There's an addition, Baruch, also a bracha, that all of these people were created in order to serve me. Hu Hayaomer. Then we have another, this connects, this statement, first statement of Ben Zoma connects to the original statement of Hamnuna and in the Tana Rabbanan, but we switch topics because Ben Zoma said something else. He's quoted in another manner, which at least seems to be unconnected. הוא היה אומר כמה יגיעות יגע אדם הראשון עד שמצא פס לאכול. How much effort did man, first man, אדם הראשון, have to make in order to get to a slice of bread to eat? Well, he had to plow, and he had to plant, and he had to cut, and he had to pile up, etc. All of these melachot. And after that, he was able to eat. V'ani mashkim u'motzei kol eilu k'shu v'tukan l'fonai. And Ivan Zomer says, I mean, what does this mean, that Adam HaRishon had to do all of these things in order to get a piece of bread? And I get up and I go to the bread cupboard, and there it is. I have a piece of bread. Kami yigiot yiga Adam HaRishon shematza beyed l'vosh. The same is true with my clothing. How much effort did first man have to make in order to produce a coat? And there's a list of all the melachot. These are all melachot that we know from Shabbat. V'ani mashkim matzei kol eilu k'shu v'tukan l'fonai. And I get up in the morning, and everything is there, ready for me. Kol umot shogdot uva'ot lefetach beiti v'ani mashkim matzei kol eilu l'fonai. Kol umot shogdot. He was apparently, at least according to Rashi, he was a very rich man. And people would come to him, and he didn't have to go anywhere. He didn't have to do anything. Who ya omer, orech tov, ma omer, kama trichot arach palabayit lefanai, kama yayin evi lefanai, kama basay evi lefanai, kama gluskaot evi lefanai, kol ator shetarach lo tarach ela bishvili, a good guest values all the effort that the Balabayit made on his behalf, how much wine, how much meat, how much cake, all of these things that he did for me. I will reach ra. Now Omer, mati uchot erach Balabayit ze, ma'yayin evi, ma'basay evi, zvot evi, kol mashu terach l'terach ala b'shvil, ishto u'banam. So that a bad guest is not impressed by what is done on his behalf. And he says, okay, you know, a little meat, a little cake, a little... He says, really, all he did was kind of make it easier for his wife and his children. Okay. What do we do now?
let me point out one or two things about how Rav Kook learns a Gadita in general, preparatory trying to understand what he says. At one point, Rabbi Govinda, you said that the two statements of Ben Zomer, at least don't on the face of it, seem to have much to do with each other. It was part of Rav Kook's shita in learning a Gadita that two statements following one after the other in the Gemara always have something to do with each other, and he usually manages to figure out what it is in quite ingenious ways. Another thing to point out before we go into what he says is that when the Gemara says kol umot shokdot uvat lepetach beiti, all peoples come eagerly and bring their stuff to my doorstep. There's in the Gemara itself, there's a tikkun girsaot which says that it ought to read kol umanuyot, all tradesmen or artists or artisans. Apparently that's what the Yushami says here, and that's very much the spirit in which Rav Kook reads it. Do we want to say anything about what we think the Gemara means before we look at what Rav Kook says?
Well, I mean, obviously, the Sirav Hamnuna and the Tana Rabbonon and the first statement in Ben Zoma, which reflects upon the wisdom that must have been necessary in order to produce so much wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow the fact that people are all capable of some sort of wisdom and not always the same wisdom, impresses the author of these statements with the Creator. Like, I mean, it itself is sort of a proof of creation, because if creation was either evolutionary or haphazard, one would think that the created would be very similar to each other. And here, the complexity of opinions is itself somehow an indication of creation. And so that's, you know, one thing that you might say. This addition in Ben Zoma, Al Gab Ma'ala Bahar Habayit. Har Habayit, what the Har Habayit has to do with this statement? In what way does it connect to Ben Zoma? The Har Habayit is a place, you know, a place which either is about which you can be optimistic or pessimistic, right? So we know that from the Gemara at the end of Makos, and I guess Ben Zoma, who himself had a checkered career philosophically, which might relate to this or might not, but somehow he says that that when you're in a place which focuses, like, which focuses religious energy somehow, it takes you out of the mundane into the divine, so then you make the bracha. It's like the bracha, maybe it's similar to the bracha nisim, which you say when you get to the place that the nes occurred, somehow it encourages you to produce the spiritual energy that's demanded as a precursor to the bracha. And he says as well that somehow that most people can't just say this bracha, Baruch HaCham HaRazim, but they need the added advantage of the Har Habayit.
Perhaps one could also say that Har Habayit is the place where all Jews came together to serve God, and everybody had their thing to do when they were there. And so the perspective of Har Habayit is a good one for appreciating the different roles that everybody has to play.
What does Baruch Shebara Kol Eila L'Shem Sheini mean? And that doesn't seem to fit in. Rashi connects it to what's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So Hu Haya Omer that, you know,
It doesn't fit in, because it seems it's viewing them from a almost a self-interested point of view. That they, you know,
it's an extra bracha.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extra bracha. Well, you know, the first bracha seems to be very exalted.
Mm-hmm.
But the second bracha, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the key to the connection between what Ben Zoma said and the Hu Haya Omer further.
Mm-hmm.
As if you were going to connect statement one and statement two, it has to be through that bracha of the Shem Sheni.
Yeah.
So I don't know exactly why the Shem Sheni is like Baruch HaCham HaRazim.
Well, and to start to anticipate what Rav Kook says about this, Rav Kook is impressed by the way in which the market division of labor, which enables everybody to do their thing, and through everybody doing their thing to produce what people need, how that can lead to a more spiritual kind of level. That because the market gives an incentive to everybody to find out what their thing is which they do best and then do it, that's an opening to a kind of a spiritual discovery of what one does best and doing it. But that's, I think that's the link which Rav Kook draws between the two statements.
Just like Chacham HaRazim is, as Rashi says, sheyodeh mashabelev kol elu, I guess meaning that there are different things, this is what I thought it meant, that different things in the different hearts, so people not only think different things, but they do different things.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe,
yes.
And that's what kol elu l'shem sheni means.
Yes.
That that serving God is something you do with whatever talent you have.
Mm-hmm.
That's baruch baruch shebarak kol elu l'shem sheni.
Mm-hmm. Through thinking or doing.
Okay.
So with those ideas in mind, and that
could,
certainly
could
begins to
begin yes. with. In other words, what happened later?
Yes.
Once upon a time, a person needed to be a jack of all trades.
Mm-hmm.
In order to get the slice of bread, you needed to be able to do each and every melacha yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Now there are artisans, and certainly whether we go with the Girsa according to the Yerushalmi or not.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, now one need not know how to do all those things in order to get his slice of bread or any other fine finished product of craftsmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not only more useful from a utilitarian perspective that it should be that way, but it also ends up producing a more refined product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's L'shem Sheni. That, in other words, each person can excel at their craft, at their malacha, in their talents, and put out a product which is you know, either useful in a utilitarian sense, like the loaf of bread, or in an aesthetic sense, like a piece of art. And that's also Chacham HaRazim.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you have 600,000 people, and just like no two look alike, each one's personality, each one's inclinations, each one's talents are. Perhaps that's the connection between the two pieces of the matter.
Yeah, I think that's right. That, I mean, for Rav Kook, this is a development. It's an advance in human history that we don't now have to do everything ourselves. That things have progressed to the point where, you know, tasks are divided and people can do what's best, which improves the quality of the finished product and also the ability of each person to excel in their own particular expertise. So with that, shall we look at what Rav Kook has to say? So he develops these ideas, I think, along the lines in which we've started to look. In page 370 of Ein Ayah, the paragraph which is marked Resh Pei Dalet 284. I'm not going to look in this in depth because of restrictions of time. But here he begins to lay out a development of ideas, commenting on the bracha. Rav Kook comments that this bracha is an expression of our sheer awe at the fact that simply everybody is different. That you look at a mass of people, they look more or less the same from a distance when you see 600,000 Jews together. But we're blessing Hashem because He knows the secrets of the individuality which resides in every single one of them. That everyone learns Torah in a different way. That everyone has skills which are unique to them. That everyone sees the world in a unique way to them. And we're blessing God because of the almost inconceivable variety and diversity within this mass, this agglomeration of people, which Hashem knows, even if we don't, and we just see a large group of people together. So there we see a source for some of the ideas about human uniqueness, which we've spoken about in the last 2 weeks, which there's no need to rehearse now. Now let's look at the paragraph Resh Pei Vav, in which Rav Kook comments on Ben Zoma's statement that how remarkable it is that whereas Adam HaRishon, who had used to do the plowing and the sowing and the reaping and everything himself to get a slice of bread, Now everybody has their own thing. There's someone to do the ploughing, someone to do the reaping, someone to do the sowing, and all these people combine together in order to bring me my loaf of bread. And so Rav Kook begins by saying that this division of labour, which is made possible by the workings of an advanced economic system, and however advanced it was in Ben Zoma's time, Rav Kook was certainly aware of how much more it was advanced in his time, and he's talking in the context of industrialization and the division of labour and the economic system which that made possible. And Rav Kook is marveling at the diversity of different human skills and talents which this organization of the process of manufacture makes possible. That's the first part of the comment. Then he continues about 12 lines up. I'm in the middle of the line. Ma ne'amar od lemiktsoa hamitrachev umanot al dat hachavat hachayim bedevarim shebau rak la'achiv da'ato shel adam kechol chochmat hayofi hatziyur hazimra ukeyotze behem shehem bechlal ha'umanuyot shehevdelei hakishronot I efshar sheyatzu la'or ki im al yedei hevdelei techunot. So Rav Kook says that whatever he said so far about the marvelous range of human skills which is necessary to produce the products of the economic products which he uses, this is kal vachomer, even more so true of the arts, of anything, the chochmat hayofi, anything which just produces beauty, drawing, painting, music, everything else. If we understand the uniqueness which is necessary to produce physical products, then far more so we understand the uniqueness which is necessary in order to produce the products, if you want to call them that, of the fine arts. Ve'eich yiyeh ha'adam sha'avu tzerachav miluim drushim hamon tchunot shonot v'nevdalot v'shebechlalam gam kein chilufim rabim v'kochot nafshiim להיות מדמה עצמו שטוב ויפה היה לעולם שיהיו כל בני אדם דומים אליו בתכונותיו ורגשותיו. שמזאת המחשבה הרעה באה חיסרון הסבלנות וצרות עין וצינת הבריות. And a failure to appreciate this. So a failure to appreciate the uniqueness which is expressed in the arts, Rav Kook says, can lead to a lack of tolerance, a meanness of spirit, and a hatred of people, which comes from this desire, this contentment to see everybody be like everybody else. So Rav Kook's teaching us, I think, something very important educationally, that the arts can be, through being a means to appreciate the value of human diversity, teach us the value of Ahavot Habriot itself. It's relatively easy to love people who are like us, but what's harder is to understand and appreciate and love people who are very different from us. And I think Rav Kook is saying here that the arts can be a means through showing to us the sheer wondrous diversity of human ways of seeing the world, which can enable us to reach this educational goal. But Rav Kook is not just doesn't stop there, because he also believes that, and as Rav Bravender was alluding to at the beginning, that this ability to appreciate the diversity of human ways of seeing the world, which the arts can teach us, can also bring us to love of creation, and through that, to love of the Creator. So it says in the last few lines of this paragraph, Kol ha'umanayot ha'shopdot u'ba'ot lepetach beiti, u'mevin koat ruach v'hafachavat da'at ba'olami ha'prati, all this range of artistic creations coming to my doorstep gives me a great deal of korach ruach, happiness, contentment, and the expansion of my spiritual world. Akenet kulam ehav v'kulam echabed, and therefore I love all of them. I will love all of them, and I will honor all of them. V'chol achilufim v'ashinuyim v'haruchukim v'shonim zeh milzeh lefi chitzoniyot eida sheyesh lahem kesher shel shalom v'achdut al pi hachachma ha'elyona hapnimit shel chacham harazim baruch hu. And in all this, the variations which I see in them, I know that they're linked together in a unity by their connection with the Chacham Harazim, Baruch Hu, the one who knows all secrets. Shebara kol eile sheshamsheni ve'et kulam echabek b'ahava, who created all of them to serve me, and I will embrace all of them in love. So I think Rav Kook is saying here that the variety of human experience which the arts can teach us can bring us, first of all, to Ahavat Habriyot, to loving creation and seeing it in their diversity, and through that to love of the Creator who brought into being all that diversity. Any comments on that?
I'm taken by this statement about Adam HaRishon first. I mean, clearly he's referring to, I think, to Adam HaRishon after he was kicked out of Gan Eden.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because in Gan Eden,
he didn't have to do it.
They didn't have to do anything. The bread grew on trees, according to the Gemara. So we're talking about Adam HaRishon after. That means that Adam HaRishon went into a world that in which he had to fend for himself. This was the reality, that you couldn't grow a piece of bread. You had to have a tremendous variety of talents in order to get that piece of bread. So that means that in the creation, when man was created, put into Gan Eden, he had all of those talents. He didn't have to use them for making bread. But had he stayed in Gan Eden longer, I guess he would have become a musician or a painter or some sort of a writer. But because he had that all in him already, and the making of the bread just brought it out. I mean, you see that he was able to do these things that he never thought he would have to do, which are really acts of expertise on some level. And therefore, to come from that to the conclusion that there are other talents, that any talent that you have is something that pre-exists the expulsion from Gan Eden, and therefore is part of the best way of living with yourself, with God, with creation, etc., may make a lot of sense, actually.
That's a lovely reading. I like that. Saying that Adam HaRishon was of humanity, all of humanity in potential. He had all of these talents.
We had them already in Gan Eden, where he didn't have to do anything.
It's the challenge of having to do something which brings it out of all of us.
But it also means that obviously this is a connection, that people are different from each other, and that in creation the desire apparently was that those differences should be noted and should be emphasized, that people who have talent should use that talent. And that's really the question of Ben Zoma. He said, okay, Adam HaRishon used all of his talents for making bread, but I don't have to do that. I have a piece of bread. So does that mean that whatever talents I have should just lie fallow and not be used for anything because I have a piece of bread? So he seems to think that that would be a bad conclusion. That you have to, okay, I can't, I'm not going to use my talents to make bread, but I've got to use it for something. And then Rav Kook's conclusion that's a prod for Avos Yisrael, and Avos Hashem. I mean, that's of course an interesting twist to it. You know, that once you are able to see the pluralistic design in creation, So then people who are not like you are less oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that's what God wanted, that people should be different from each other, then who could argue with that? I guess.
Well, Ronnie, you yourself have made the point that art can bring us to Ahavat Hashem. Well, what do you think of Rav Cook's additional point that can bring us to Ahavat HaBriyot?
Ahavat HaBriyot, I think it means when you see that people are different.
Yeah.
And that they would have to express themselves differently. And even if it doesn't always meet favor with me personally, like I don't always understand what he's doing, but Ahava, I guess, means being able to overcome the limits of diversity and to see the bigger picture of creation in which every talent is somehow generated by God in creation. So that brings to Ahavat Adam, I guess. I mean, art brings to Abbas, could bring to Abbas Hashem because we need things. We need something to push us in that direction so that art might be. But here we're talking about once you recognize the diversity, even if I can't be entirely sympathetic to what someone is doing, like as an artist who's very avant-garde, and I'm just not capable of absorbing his mindset, but I can see in what he does a divine expression, and therefore, you know, my relationship to him would change.
Underlying this this comment from Rav Cook is an optimistic 19th century viewpoint that the economic developments of industrialization and division of labor, which, as we said before, brought everybody to do what they was most specialized and expert in doing, could be the basis, the substructure for a kind of human spiritual flourishing in which everybody could do spiritually what they would be best able to do as well. I believe that's in Hegel. And Rav Cook's reading that out of the Gemara, the connection between the division of economic functions and spiritual and artistic functions. I mean, I think since then, I think people have been a bit disappointed with that a notion, and that, you know, advanced in industrial societies don't necessarily naturally lead to everybody expressing their uniqueness spiritually and so on. And would we say that, you know, that art is a way, a realm in which one can express that even after we've been disappointed of the possibility of doing it in our work and professional lives?
I'm not sure. I think the Industrial Revolution also produced a situation where people did meaningless work. I mean, it might at some later stage be connected to some other meaningless work in a more meaningful manner, but it's not like Zorea and Dash and Kotzer where you start it and you finish it. You know, you reach, it's a melacha. It's something that's done. Whereas people spend their whole life, filling boxes or something might not be able, it might be more difficult to see the point to it. Whereas artists always finish. I mean, that's what, you know, all creative activity has an end, has a beginning, it has an end. And so I think that the comparison...
Even the unfinished symphony.
Yeah, but I think the comparison is, you know, to the Industrial Revolution may be correct as an idea, but I'm not sure that practically the people felt about what they were doing the way Ben Zoma thinks about making bread, you know, where you actually, like you went through the stages and you did it, and you had each stage has a beginning and an end. But, you know, people who were not, you know, you weren't able to see the bigger picture. So if you tightened the screw on a car, you never saw the car, but the screw showed up every 2 minutes. So it was a little bit too difficult to grasp the world-shaking importance of what you were doing.
Right. Being the best there is at tightening that screw doesn't necessarily do it for you spiritually.
Yeah, it's not just being the best, but it's seeing how what you're doing ends up in a desirable product or a desirable way.
Mm-hmm.
That is also difficult.
Yeah.
But if you make a piece of bread, so you made a piece of bread. I mean, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
do you think that this kind of modern industrial life stymied the creative impulse? In other words, the widget maker in the factory.
I think it hurt. You know, it was painful. People didn't have any sense of what they were doing. Well, I mean, they were doing it in order to live, but then that also didn't have so much of a point. And that's why the future will be better, because robots will turn the screws, and people will have to do things that use up more of their creative abilities, because anything else will be done by another robot. So people will be trained, they'll train themselves to do real things.
I think at a certain point, the Romantics realized that something was going very badly wrong with this promise of industrialism, and that it wasn't good for most people's human spiritual flourishing at all. And then for them, because the arts became as a protected reservation where this kind of human spiritual capacities could flower, because we've given up on it happening in most of the rest of life.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. So let's look at the Ralph Cook's paper on the continuation of this idea in Resh Pei Zion.
On page 371.
How much longer should I take to go through this? Okay. So Ralph Cook is commenting here on the Gemara statement that what does a good guest say? A good guest says how generous it was of the host to go to all this trouble just for my benefit. He'd make these cakes, go prepare this food. All for me. What a wonderful guy. But the bad guest says precisely the opposite. He says, all this trouble which the Balabayat went to, he did not for me at all. Just for the benefit of it himself and his family. See, it seems like a homely little description of good and bad manners if you're a guest. But Ralph Cook does rather more than that with it. He says there are two types of people who the Gemara is describing here. There's a certain type of person whose outlook is permeated so much with doubt and despair and skepticism about what he sees around him that he's simply unable to trust and to believe in the good of what he sees and what's done for him. There must be a catch. There's got to be an ulterior motive somewhere to anybody who fears to do anything generous for him at all. As opposed to the other type of person who's aware of goodness in himself, aware of the source of goodness and generosity from the goodness which Hashem brings him in the world. And so he's just disposed to see things differently. If someone does him a favor, he sees good in it. If a host makes him go to a lot of trouble, he says, thanks very much, very kind of you. He can appreciate and see the kindness and goodness which is given to him because he sees its source in the Tov which comes from Hashem. And what Ralph Cook says is what's striking about this situation that Gemara is describing is the two people are in exactly the same situation. The Bala Bayit is doing exactly the same thing for both of them. What's different is what's inside each person, which disposes one to view the whole thing with skepticism and doubt, and the other to see it with gratitude and thanks. And Rav Kook goes on to say that this characteristic of the, what he calls the Baal Ayin Tova is, has the effect of magnifying what we see about the goodness in creation. If we look in the left-hand column about 12 lines down, two words in, Va'amar, I've marked it on the text, Va'amar Shabal Ha'ayin Tova Yagdil Kolpa'a Lefi HaTechuna Ha'Enoshit HaMityacheset L'Shira Mitoch Oneg V'Hachavat Hadat Al HaMechazeh Ma'aseh HaShem HaNehadarim Ma'gadlu Ma'aseh HaShem. Rav Kook says that this characteristic of being a Baal Ayin Tova, someone who's able to see the good in the world, has the effect of placing under a magnifying glass the very good that we see. And this is related to the human capacity for shira, for song, for poetry. And because out of the joy which we experience from putting our magnifying glass on the good we feel about the world, we naturally feel like singing, like expressing it in the form of poetry or song or art. The consequence of Ma Gadlu Ma'asecha Hashem, understanding how great are your works Hashem, is B'Ma'ase Yadecha Aranein. Also Pasuk from Tehillim, Lamed Zayin, your works Hashem I will glorify. V'Hashira Harei Hi Gam Ken Yitzira Nafshit HaNechona La'aneg Et HaAdam Ba'oneg Ruchani La'habot Sasonei V'Tova. And this song, this poetry, is a way of expressing and redoubling the joy and pleasure which we feel and when we appreciate the good in the world. V'hamabit ba'ayin yafeh yireh tov gam b'chelek hashiri gam b'mash hadimayon yuchal liyot nehene mimenu gam ken yodeh al zeh la'ashem chasto shiyatsa et olam ba'ofen hagun kazeh sheyesh gam ken makom shahana'ot adinot v'na'alot al yedei koach hashira Zachor ki taski pa'alo asher shoru anashim. So Rav Kook is saying that there's a double effect which is produced by poetry or by the arts which he's talking about here. It's not just the ability to see the good in the world, but the ability to appreciate the arts is the capacity to appreciate people's appreciation of the good in the world, to enhance one's understanding, one's appreciation of God by appreciating the way other people's appreciation of God in the world was expressed through their form of art. And in contrast, the Baal Ayin Ra'ah deprives himself of both forms of goodness, not just the inability to see God in the world and to see goodness in the world, but also an inability to see and appreciate the way people have appreciated God's goodness in the world. He's doubly deprived in that way. Just to finish off with a final idea from this passage, which I think ought to be part of the arsenal of every single Jewish educator in today's skeptical and relativistic age. Rav Kook has spoken in the passages which we've seen about tolerance, and now he proceeds to qualify that in a very important way. The last line of page 371, he says, "Umitoch ha'ayin ha'tova, tova kol tov, umimena yatzet va'aleha sheba midat ha'sov lanot." Ha-mushubechet, ota shehi mashachlelet et ha-olam u-meviya oto v'shichlulo. This ability to see and appreciate the good in the world is the foundation for a kind of tolerance which is praiseworthy. The ability to see the goodness and the godly spark in everything leads to a kind of open-mindedness, a kind of tolerance, which is very important, Rav Kook says. And he certainly exemplified that kind of tolerance in his life and his relationships with the you know, the secular thinkers and leaders around him, the ability to see the goodness, spark of goodness, even in people whose way of life and ideals were very far from his own. But then he says, "Lo hasavlanut hamavia laakirat kol tov minha olam bishvil pezizot shaba ki hasavlanut hara'a ba mitoch ha'achlata harikaniot shahakol shamam v'akol rik v'ein yitaron l'tuchuna ala tuchuna mitoch shakol ha'nituyot ha'enoshiyot v'chol ha'mitsuyot b'chlal ha'kol hevel zot hasavla anasavlanot hi mevale olam uba me'ayin ra'a." I think Ralph Cook is saying something astonishingly insightful here. He's saying this, what he's just spoken about, is very different from the bad, the evil kind of tolerance, which comes from a decision that there's nothing of value in the world, that everything is empty, everything is meaningless, that a kind of a despair of finding anything of truth and value in the world, and that therefore, you know, anything is just about just as well the same. You might as well say whatever to anything you see, it's all the same. And this leads to a kind of a specious tolerance, Rav Cook is saying, which is mevaleh olam, which swallows up, which destroys the world, and it comes actually not from a kind of a love or appreciation of any other point of view, but from ayin ra'ah, from an inability to see any good in anything, and therefore anything is just as good as anything else.
But it's not merely the aesthetic good of a particular piece of art, mm-hmm, about which people of good intention can debate and disagree.
Mm-hmm.
And in some cases we can come to consensus that this has no, a certain thing has virtually no aesthetic value.
Mm-hmm.
But also, so again, it's not merely the work itself, but the effort of the artist that Rav Cook is emphasizing we ought to appreciate.
Yes.
In other words, and that's what comes out of the Gemara. It's the work of the individual. It's the talent of the tradesman. It's the talent of the artist. It's the talent of these people that come to my door, says Ben Zoma, from which I can benefit.
Yes.
And the focus is, it's a subtle emphasis, but I think it means a great deal.
Yes.
It's not merely that I can go online and order anything and it miraculously shows up at my door.
Yes.
It's the connection to the artisan,
yes,
as well, and his talents, not merely to the product.
Yes. I think that's a very important point. I think, Ralph Cook would say that, Ben Zoma would say that, and painting a bottle of a can of Campbell's tomato soup is not the same as Rembrandt. Just because you call it art, it doesn't mean it's art. It's the yigiyas, the skill and the effort which goes into it, is also important, and that's also what has to be appreciated.
And actually, as we're speaking, I'm trying to find in this little booklet that we have a talk by Wendy Beckett, Sister Wendy Beckett, who is a popular television host, who goes around talking about art and artists. So in a conversation that she had on PBS, an interview that Bill Moyers conducted with her, he asked her about Andre Serrano's photograph called The Piss Christ,
mm-hmm,
which is a photograph, and if the listeners want, they can Google those words and find copies of it. The Piss Christ, the Urine Christ, you'll pardon me, gentle listeners, in which an artist took a little plastic figurine of Jesus on the cross, placed it into some kind of jar, filled the jar with his own urine, and photographed it. And this created quite a stir in the United States because I believe it was part of an exhibit that was supported by the National Endowment for the Arts, and has created a big controversy in the United States. So in the interview, Moyers asks this Sister Wendy, who's I believe a Carmelite nun, what she thinks of this. And she says something like, she thinks it's wonderful. It's not very good art, she says.
Uh-huh.
But it's interesting to watch somebody try to say something about something through his art. Now her shot in what the artist was trying to do was probably different than many people thought. She thought it was trying to, you know, give a little musser to what American culture does to Jesus, which is to urinate on him. And she thought that was, you know, the artist was trying to bear around. Whether he was or he wasn't is not important to her. But again, here, the work itself, no doubt, was objectionable to her on some level. But it's not merely the work she's appreciating, but the effort, or at least her interpretation of the effort of the artist, which is probably, is a difficult mixture, both the objective and the subjective, and it relates to the question of the degree to which the consumer of the art, the viewer of the art, can interpret the art freed from what the artist, him or herself, meant.
No, I mean, that puts into words something I've felt about modern art, but not really been able to express, that, you know, even when there's a good chup there, you know, you want to say, you know, but anybody could have done that. And just being able to think of the chup shouldn't be, you know, enough to make it put it in the museum. But there's something, surely you have to have the yigiya as well in order to make it a work.
I found the quote. It's in a transcript from this interview. Perhaps on another occasion we'll have opportunity to talk about what that particular art scholar thinks. So Moyers asks her, "Were you not offended when you looked at Andre Serrano's Piss Christ? Didn't you find that denigrating of the central figure of your faith?" So Sister Wendy responds, "Well, actually no, because I thought he was saying, in a rather simplistic, magazine-y type of way, that this is what we are doing to Jesus. We're not treating him with reverence. His great sacrifice is not used. We live very vulgar lives. We put Jesus in a bottle of urine in practice. It was a very admonitory work. Not a great work, because one wouldn't want to go on looking at it once once one had, to one's distress, seen it once, but I think to call it blasphemous is really rather begging the question. It could be. It could not be. It's what you, I imagine she means you, the viewer, make of it. And I could make something that made me feel a deep desire to reverence, Jesus, which is, I guess, part of her faith, more than this suggestion. This is what, in practice, the world is doing." So Moyers then goes on to ask her about the subjectivity of interpretation, which is an interesting topic in and of itself, and perhaps something we should discuss in the future.
Yeah, I think, well, Cook was a big yeshikai to Sister Wendy.
Right, you know. We hope we haven't offended any of our listeners, but I think it's an important point.
Well, what about this idea of art being able to put on a magnifying glass the good which certain people are able to see in the world, and help us appreciate it doubly, not just seeing the good itself, but seeing the good that somebody else sees in it?
I think Rav Kook is referring very much to the interpersonal relationships that are the result of the creative effort. But he's not in any way trying to make judgments about the creative effort. It's almost similar to like the literature position on Talmud Torah. It's good for you, and it's good for the people who you're sitting next to, and it's good for the people in the room to be together learning Torah. And this is in spite of the particular achievement of the person sitting in the seat in the front or the person sitting in the seat in the back. I mean, that's a different question and has nothing to do with the ethic of Talmud Torah. So a Glock tells Rav Kook, and he says, look, people are creative. That doesn't mean that they're good. They may have started too late. They may have not had proper training. They may be international washouts. But they nevertheless have this creative energy. And being able to appreciate the fact that people tend to be creative if allowed to be is something that is positive. I mean, he hasn't made any statement about the quality of the result. I mean, Rav Kook certainly knew the difference between a chidush that was noteworthy and a chidush which was irrelevant. Nevertheless, and that doesn't mean that the irrelevant chidush, and historically irrelevant, was not important to the person who promulgated it, and did not, you know. So I think you can't get these two things mixed up, right? According to that story, which is either true or apocryphal, but he saw Rembrandt, he said, oh, here's a creative person who actually did it, because I can become a shutaf, a partner in his creativity. But even if somebody produces something which does not give that result, he is still, okay, he's doing it, he's not Rembrandt, but he's doing what he can do. And that fits into the topic. We shouldn't, like, you know, there is nothing in Rav Kook about quality. And he's talking about human beings. He said human beings have this capacity, and it should be allowed to develop, to exist. It has benefits for the individual, and has side benefits for the community. Okay? But then that has nothing to do with what you produce. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's Campbell soup cans, or if it's, you know, whatever that was, or if it's Rothko. I mean, it doesn't matter. Even though it does matter on the level of relating to creativity, which is a different topic. In other words, my own creativity could be enhanced by relating to, by learning to relate to somebody else's creative effort on, in a more intimate way, which is not the topic, I think, that Rav Kook was dealing with. He's just talking about the fact that people are creative by nature, and that they should be allowed to express themselves. And even if they don't do such a good job, I mean, what difference does that make?
So what I think we've seen in this very fascinating piece of Rav Kook is how appreciating art and the human individuality which goes into an effort which goes into creating it can be an education in appreciating value as such in all areas of life. It goes against the lazy, you know, that, you know, it's all the same, no value's better than any other, I can't judge anybody else's religion or culture or art or way of life, it's all the same. No, Rav Kook says that's a kind of relativism which is based on despair, ultimately, about there being any value at all. And art can teach us to see real value and to recognize it in a way which can lead us to a tolerance which is rooted in an ability to truly see the good and the godly in everything.